Hi, I'm Leanne Jackson, senior law editor at Forbes, and today I am joined with former federal prosecutor and professor of white-collar criminal law at George Washington University Law School, Randall Eliason. And he is a frequent commenter on an analyst on what's going on with the many Trump cases, and in particular, of course, what's happening currently, the hush money trial in New York City. We also had, of course, yesterday oral arguments, Supreme Court oral arguments on the immunity issue in the DC case. But thank you so much for joining me, Professor Eliason. I appreciate it.
Sure, my pleasure.
Would you talk a little bit about today? David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, was on the stand again. He was being cross-examined by Trump's team. He was talking about more payments to, this time, to Karen McDougal, who's also a former porn star, and how that played into this concept that the prosecution is trying to push, that there was a conspiracy with President Trump at the center of it. Can you talk a little bit about how the cross-examination went and where the defense is heading and or trying to head off that theory?
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're going to try to do with Pecker. They didn't get too far into the cross yet, but of course she's the prosecution's lead witness and really laying out the whole story of this pattern they had of the catch and kill, they call them, sort of trying to head off any negative stories about Trump during the campaign and make sure they never saw the light of day. I'm not sure they can really dispute a lot of that. So, I think what they will probably try to, I mean, I don't think they can dispute that it happened, but they'll try to suggest it was primarily Michael Cohen and Pecker and maybe others in the Trump organization, and that Trump himself was not terribly involved. He was just, he's got people to handle that stuff for him, right? So that'll be probably the pitch is to, I don't think they're going to attack Pecker too hard. I mean, and try to call him a liar, but I think they'll just try to sort of minimize the effect by saying, well, maybe this happened, but it was political operatives working on the campaign. It was Cohen, and Trump himself wasn't really that focused on it, probably that kind of thing.
How do you feel? Okay, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
His prosecution's lead witness, it seems like he's coming across pretty well, telling a pretty compelling story. And that's what you want to lead off with. The first and last witnesses are the kind of folklore. They're the most important, right? That's what the jury's really going to remember. So not surprising that they led off with him. And I think he's told a pretty compelling story of this, really having the campaign, really having this major media company kind of working on its behalf, which is pretty extraordinary. It may not have been illegal itself, but it was pretty extraordinary to have the kind of working hand in hand with the campaign the way he apparently was.
And he talked about that a lot of the way they arranged the hush money payments, at least to Karen McDougal, were intended to avoid triggering campaign finance laws, which is part of the prosecution's case, at least I believe on the misdemeanor level, that that's the first stage to establishing the conspiracy, which is what they're really going for. Is that correct?
Yeah, to make these, so these the charges are just falsifying business records, and that's normally a misdemeanor. So to make it a felony, they have to have an underlying crime that they're alleging that the false records were trying to conceal or further somehow. And the underlying crime that they're focused on is an election crime. So they're saying, that these catch and kill schemes were unlawful campaign contributions, basically, and that was a conspiracy to influence the election. And that's not what Trump is charged with, but the argument is that's what his intent was when the records were falsified, was to help cover up that underlying election fraud conspiracy.
What kind of a hurdle and how hard do you think it will be for the prosecution to create that nexus and to get that to the next level from just, this is business finance, this is just financial records, to actually convince a jury and convince the public that there was a broader conspiracy and that involved election fraud and that Trump was at the center of this, to actually get a conviction on that? What are your thoughts? I mean, you worked as the in the U.S. Attorney's Office for D.C. as a chief of the public corruption section. So, from your experience and analyzing what's happening, what do you think?
I feel like it's a pretty strong case. The government's going to put on a pretty compelling case. So these documents cases like this, they're really hard to defend against usually because the documents kind of speak for themselves, right? I mean, the documents are false, I don't think they're going to really be able to dispute that they were false, although it sounds like they'll try. You know, they're going to try to suggest that they were actually paying Michael Cohen for real legal services and there was nothing false about them. But I think that's, you know, the approach the defense has taken, at least based on their opening, is really aggressive. It's sort of, you know, these weren't false and everybody else is lying and everybody's just out to get the president. Instead of something maybe a little more nuanced, which could have been, well, he didn't want his family to find out about this. So yes, he, you know, paid to have the stories, bought and suppressed, but it wasn't about the campaign. It was about personal embarrassment in his family. And it's kind of a natural thing, you know, try to kind of downplay it that way without necessarily saying everybody's lying. But that's the approach they've taken. So I think that combined with the strength of the government's case is going to be pretty compelling. You know, Michael Cohen, of course, kind of the star witness, has a lot of baggage, but there will be a lot of things to back up everything he says, including Pecker's testimony, you know, already. So the jury's not going to have to take just Michael Cohen's word for anything. You know, everything he says is going to be backed up by other witnesses and by the documents. And I think when you put it all together, it's going to be pretty strong case.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, in terms of putting on the first witness, choosing David Pecker instead of Michael Cohen, David Pecker doesn't have the same sort of baggage. And in fact, he was a confidant of former President Trump. So, and to your point as well about that everyone's lying, clearly they're going to try to impeach and poke holes in the testimony when Michael Cohen does get on the stand and call him a serial liar, a convicted liar. But you mentioned that the documents speak for themselves. However, there's no way to necessarily know direct evidence that former President Trump specifically ordered these things to happen. It does become his word versus the other witnesses. Is that how it might play out? Or you feel
yes,
that the
I think that, you know,
is not?
Yeah, I think the best chance the defense has is that kind of suggestion that he really didn't get his hands dirty with all the details, you know? So there was this scheme going on involving Cohen and Pecker and Alan Weisselberg and some others, but he wasn't really focused on the details. They put the checks in front of him and he signed them and, you know, he wasn't really paying attention. That's probably kind of their best argument. Although again, they didn't really say that in an opening. They said in opening, they said everybody's lying and the documents weren't false. So, but yeah, challenging his personal involvement, I think, will be one approach. But, you know, there are going to be multiple witnesses. You know, Pecker and Cohen and Hope Hicks and maybe others who are going to testify about conversations where Trump himself was involved and where this plot was hatched. So, and I think it's been pretty hard to take the approach that everybody's lying. But that appears to be what they're going to try to do.
Right. And at some point it does become, the jury will have to weigh all the testimony and make a determination whether there is actually concrete written documentation that Trump was behind certain things. It's a question of balancing the evidence. That would be the obligation of the jury. Let me pivot a little bit towards the gag order decision that's looming in this trial. President Trump may have been, I don't know if circumspect is the word, but he hasn't maybe said as much as he did during the E. Jean Carroll trial, where he lost hundreds of millions in a civil judgment recently. But the prosecution has brought a number of issues to the attention of the judge. And apparently there were four additional alleged violations that were brought up today. Can you speak a little bit to that of how you think the judge will handle that? And of course, whether this is the normal course of action where a defendant is making all sorts of statements that are potentially prejudicial or against violating a gag order.
Yeah, I think, you know, his options are, I think, a maximum fine of $1,000 per violation or up to 30 days in jail per violation. I don't expect him to try to put Trump in jail, at least right away. You'd expect him to start with fines and warnings, you know, that incarceration is a possibility if this continues. I think, you know, again, a typical defendant, there would have been some sanctions long ago by now, and the judge is really bending over backwards, given the fact that the president is also a political candidate and is in the middle of a campaign and is making all these arguments about his need to defend himself. Even if they're not terribly persuasive, I think the judge is bending over backwards to try to, you know, accommodate all these competing interests. But he seems to take the violation seriously, although, again, you know, I don't know why we don't have a decision yet on the first 10. It doesn't seem like it would take that long. And there were four more, like you said, four more instance fossil violations where the judge signed an order today, but the hearing isn't until next Wednesday. So it's almost a week, you know, when the violations could presumably continue. So he doesn't seem to be acting with, you know, great urgency when it comes to enforcing the possible violations. But
you think it's important for a judge to take a strong stand on that? I mean, Judge Erdogan had levied a number of fines, if I recall correctly, in the other case, and spoke strongly out against this. But as you mentioned, it seems to be a little bit more of a slower response by this judge. And of course, you have to take into consideration all the aspects of the case whenever it's any high profile client, and it doesn't get more high profile than this. But what is important in this kind of a scenario, because there are concerns about what it means for the case, for the jurors, a lot of issues.
Sure. Yeah. And he's got a tough job. I mean, I think the judge in general, Judge Michon's been doing a really excellent job managing this case and keeping the trial moving forward. And I don't envy him trying to do this balancing test, you know, between this defendant and trying to avoid giving him yet something else to either take up on appeal or make himself look like a martyr in the public eye or things like that. And yet enforcing the gag order, which is designed to maintain the integrity of the trial and to protect the jurors and protect potential witnesses. And you know, it's really, it's not an easy thing to balance all those competing interests. So, but I think in general, he's been doing a really good job of moving the case forward and managing the trial.
Is there anything else you've noticed that we haven't discussed about this case and how it's progressing that's important for observers to realize or the public to note?
Well, I think the underlying legal the underlying crime that makes it a felony, like we were talking about earlier, you know, the main focus has been on this campaign conspiracy. I'm interested to see how that state kind of fleshes that out, because they haven't been 100% clear, at least I don't think, on whether they're primarily talking about a federal campaign violation or a state conspiracy campaign violation. They've even mentioned at different times a tax violation, you know, a tax law violation. Maybe that's the underlying law that they were trying to conceal. You know, and they're going to need to pick one at some point, or you know, argue. Maybe they'll argue all three, but they seem to be a little less than clear so far on which one it's going to be, what their primary focus is, what their legal theory is, and that could affect how the judge ends up instructing the jury, how the case ultimately goes. So I'm kind of curious to see how that all plays out. The basic facts are not super complicated, you know, the falsifying of documents in the story, you know, things like that. But some of the underlying legal theories are a little more complicated in terms of how you make this a felony and why.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, jury instructions are crucial, as we just saw in the Weinstein case, where you know, you have to make sure that the jury instructions are clear, and of course, which theory of prosecution you're going forward with. And do you feel like this may have been, you know, Alvin Bragg delayed bringing this case? A number of prosecutors who resigned from his office because initially he declined to move forward with prosecuting Trump. Do you believe that potentially they're a little bit of not a lack of direction, but lack of specificity isn't just necessarily a trial tactic, but could do with the fact that they were a little bit unsure about how to proceed in the strongest possible way with a case?
I don't know if it's that. I mean, they're not required to specify more in the indictment. You know, they're allowed to keep these options open, and so that gives them kind of maximum flexibility. And I think if you've got that option, you take it, right? Because then it allows you to see how the trial plays out and how the evidence is coming in, and you can kind of adopt your presentation accordingly. So, you know, if they didn't have to be pin themselves down 100% earlier on, then I think it makes sense that they didn't. I kind of leave that flexibility for them to possibly, you know, take advantage of as the trial goes on. So we're just gonna have to see how it ends up is what's most important, right? How do they end up arguing to the case of the jury in closing, and how the jury get instructed? And that's gonna depend on how the evidence comes in.
So that's very interesting. Yeah, so they're able to play their cards close to the vest up until the very end. And that's part of their strategy, clearly. And the element of surprise is always a positive to have. I really appreciate you joining me and giving your analysis of the trial, what's been happening today, day 7 of the trial, and of course, the cumulative case that's going forward. So thank you for joining me, and I really appreciate your time.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks.